Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mackett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackett.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foodish.
Yep.
Welcome back to another episode of Not the Footy Show. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And me, John Lee.
And there's been plenty happening in the past week in sport. I suppose, first of all, John, we should turn our attention to the Rugby Championship. And the Rugby Championship finished. Australia won.
Great news for Australia.
Yep, but as I said, I think before, bad news is no team that's ever won the Tri Nations or the Rugby Championship has lifted the World Cup. When they've won it in a World Cup year.
That's the sort of statistic that goes alongside New Zealand's never won it outside of New Zealand. Doesn't mean it can't happen,
absolutely,
but it's telling.
Well, those sort of records are there to be broken. I mean, the All Blacks won in Eden Park. I don't think there was any great surprise there, personally. You always knew they were going to get up after losing in Sydney.
Perhaps the score?
Yeah.
Oh, that was disappointing. I would have liked to have thought Australia might have kept them a few points less and scored a few points more, but that's the result.
I think the worrying thing was how Australia were restricted to so little ball and what they were able to do with it. That to me was more of a concern than anything else.
I'll bet you next time Australia plays New Zealand, Pocock and Hooper start.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and I would have thought keeping them. They've got one more game now before the World Cup against the USA. New Zealand have no more warm-up games. They're going straight into the World Cup, which starts on September the 18th. Who's your tip?
Oh, Australia. But then I'd like to see Ireland win it. I can see Ireland winning it. I'm not going to tip New Zealand.
It's funny because you said before how those records are there to be beaten. Australia's only two titles have both been won in Europe. So I think they have to go in there as one of the top three favourites on that record alone. All Blacks, no team has ever managed to defend their Rugby World Cup title, so it's going to be tough. I can't see South Africa recovering. I think they've just hung on to too many old players for way too long. And if Heineken Meyer brings in new faces now, it's going to be way, way too late. I think the All Blacks will be there or thereabout. I think the Wallabies were. I think a Northern Hemisphere team is probably going to lift it this time. My bet is Ireland as well. Although I think England, you cannot discount them because when they do play well, they play very well. And, of course, the unknown is France.
I was going to mention them, of course. With all these names we're mentioning, the one team that's going to come through and make something of it will be them. If there's a surprise packet, or it'll be the French.
Yep, we'll have to wait and see. And, of course, the National Rugby Championship gets underway over here. Western Force have got quite a few of their players playing in that. 7 players from the Pindown Premier League, 12 players returning to the Spirit. And there's a few players that are going to be playing their first games for the Spirit this year. Number 8, Angus Cottrell, and flanker Chris Alcock, who missed last year because they were recovering from injuries. Now, one thing here that frustrates me a little bit is we're getting these publicity things saying all games live on Fox Sports. Well, they're actually not, because you have to pay another subscription on top to get the streaming app to be able to watch them streaming. So I don't know if that's false advertising, but the interesting thing is talking to some people, because they've done the same with the FFA Cup. It's only $10, which, okay, it's not a lot of money, but there are a lot of people going, hang on a sec, I pay enough for the subscription, which is not that good anyway, all the TV programs that are on there. Why should I have to pay another $10? And if you're saying you're showing them live, they should be live on the TV.
I would have thought live meant as it happened, not it happened and we were there to film it live.
Yeah. But I mean, look, they're showing it live, streaming it if you want to get that. But I still think there's... I do wonder whether, you know, the FFA and the Australian Rugby Union are going to get into a bit of a bind with this. There's no doubt that streaming is the way to go and it's really getting momentum. But I'm just wondering if they're locking themselves into Fox with all of these things. So they're going to be doing their digital media, they're going to be doing the TV media. I just think they should be spreading that around, because I think it's in their interests to maybe sell the TV rights, sell the streaming rights.
Well, we've just seen the largest sporting code in the country, the AFL, rack up a $2.5 billion sporting rights. But that's free-to-air, that's for television. And the way they've managed to package their sport, and NRL has followed that as well. And basketball's looking at the same sort of thing. You need free-to-air exposure of some sort of description. But as you say, going into the future, it is the digital rights, you know, platforms, telephones, what do they call the little type? I can't remember the name.
Tablets.
Tablets, that's the one. That's how technologically
savvy I am. Now, the AFL don't like tablets.
We might get our first guest on. What do you think?
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, as we do on these podcasts, we like to have a few guests, as we used to have on the radio show when we were on air. And this week, we've got a really, really interesting guest. I thought this was an amazing story. He's a top businessman in Perth, a gentleman by the name of Mal Brown, and he'd always dreamt of cycling across America. Now, not only did he achieve this, but also raised a great deal of money for a really worthwhile cause and one of the charities, and he went with a number of other people from Western Australia. Mal Brown, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're talking to you today because you just did what some would say was a crazy trip, cycling across America, the Trans-American Challenge.
Yeah, look, I've been looking at it for about a decade, 15 years maybe, and I thought, you know, before I get too old, before I get too broken down, I'd better go do it. And it really spilt out of that.
You were doing it for charity, which was that one of the spurs as well?
Yeah, well, look, I decided we wanted to do it. My wife and I wanted to do it. And then she said, well, if we're going to do all of this riding, the least we can do is see if we can raise some money for what is a charity that we've supported for quite a number of years, so Wheelchairs for Kids. So, you know, we just added it to it as another incentive to, you know, get ourselves to go from the west to the east as safely as possible. So it wasn't the primary incentive, but it was most certainly an addition to the ride.
You said it was something you'd wanted to do for a long time. How had you first come aware of such a ride?
I'd followed a blog of an ABC reporter, an Australian Broadcasting reporter, who'd gone to the USA and in the early 2000s had done a ride across America. And I used to read his updates each day, and I thought, gee, one day I'd love to do that. And one day eventually arrived.
Did you have to do a lot of training for it, or was it... You already pretty fit and had your bike out every day.
I've been riding, with a bunch of friends for about a decade. But I figured I needed to do more, because if you're going to do 120, 130 k's a day every day, you know, for a long period of time, I figured I needed to have a better base level of exercise under me. So I had done a fair bit of work in the year leading up to that, which is probably over and above what I'd normally done with my normal cycle group.
So I think the distance was 6,600 kilometres. So how long did it take you?
So it was a 10-week program. So we were generally trying to ride for 6 days and then rest for one. And so we were doing roughly, you know, 120 kilometres a day over that 10-week period. And some days they were very long, some days were 190, 200 k's, other days were short days. And it all really depended upon where we could get accommodation when I'd been planning the route. It had a lot to do with where could you get accommodation, how hilly was it, how flat was it. So obviously those flatter days were the ones we did 200 k's, and the hilly ones were the ones we did, you know, the 80 or 90 k days.
Now, you mentioned that you went with your wife, but I believe there were a few other people that went with you. Was it easy to coerce others into it?
Yeah, I just sort of put it out there and said, you know, this is what I'm planning to do. Who'd be interested? And I cycle with a fair number of people. I know a fair number. To be honest, it wasn't actually that hard to attract people interested to do it. Obviously, you know, people getting 10 or 12 weeks break so they can go and do this ride from beginning to end is quite difficult. So I had a number of people who just came for two or three weeks and then have to go back to work. I think most of them regret not being able to do the whole lot, because it was an absolute blast.
I'm sure it was, although one thing that did scare me was 267 hours in the saddle.
Yes, as I say, so my wife, my buttocks and the seat are now two north ends of magnets. They refuse to be connected in any shape or form for a little while.
I'm sure. And the other thing I found amusing reading the blog was that the organiser was actually called the bastard occasionally.
Oh, there was a few days where there were some really tough days, and the second last day was 160 kilometres. It was hilly, and I think everyone had mentally decided we're very close to the end now. It must be getting easier, but it got a bit ugly, and I think everyone was hoping to cruise quietly into the East Coast and flop in the water, and that would be it. But there was a couple of long days at the back end.
And I mean, how high were some of those hills you had to go up? Because it looked as if the gradient of some were incredible.
Well, you've got to get over the Rockies, so there's a steady incline. And I think the highest peak we had to go over just outside of Breckenridge was 11,600 feet. I'll give you it in feet because that's what it was on the mountain and the conversion to metres. I'll leave someone else to do that. But there was a lot of hills. I mean, you've got to go through the Rockies, you've got to go through the Ozarks, you've got to go through the Appalachians. You know, there's a lot of hills that you had to get up. Rockies were long but not too steep. Ozarks and the Appalachians were shorter hills but got to be, you know, 10 to 15%, and that starts to hurt when you're trying to ride up 5 or 6Ks.
No, I'm sure it was. And there was another bit where your support crew actually got lost one day. Was that a little bit of a moment's panic there?
No, because they disappeared off. We rather than carrying all our camping gear, we hired a car and put all our luggage in the back, and then we had people who weren't riding, not interested in doing the riding part, but wanted to be the tourists driving for us. And it would be helpful if they would meet us for lunch or whatever, but a couple of times they just got completely lost, and we found them at the end of the day. We eventually found them at the end of the day, but there's lots of hotels, lots of places along the way you can stop and get a drink or something to eat. So it wasn't too bad. If they'd lost us in Kansas, it would have been different because there was hundreds of kilometres between towns and hot, but it was impossible to get lost there. It was just one straight road that just kept going and going and going.
Were there many maintenance issues at all?
No, surprisingly enough, I don't think I got a flat tyre. My wife didn't get a flat tyre. We probably, between all of us, and there was generally eight people riding, we probably only had about 6 or 8 flat tyre, maybe 10 flat tyres in the total time. One guy had a little bit of trouble with his bike, but other than that, you know, very, very few mechanical problems across that road.
You did have one of your riders fall off while stationary and injure himself.
I shouldn't laugh because he actually injured himself fairly seriously. He was trying to take a photo. He had a leg clipped in. The bike slipped on some gravel, and unfortunately the big chain cog at the front dug into his calf, sliced through his calf and sliced through half of his tendon. So, in fact, that was the end of his riding. He'd got through 8 weeks. He had 2 weeks to go. He'll never live down the fact that he fell off a stationary bike, but I actually did feel sorry for him at the time that he couldn't finish that job.
Has he made a full recovery now?
He's back in Perth. He obviously came back to Perth, but he actually had to go in for an operation this week to have the cut cleaned up because it's still a bit infected and they weren't unsure about the tendon, so they wanted to have another look at the tendon. So he's confined to his house at the moment, which is probably driving him completely mad.
I'm sure it is. And the other thing I found interesting was Kentucky, where you had sort of other obstacles to avoid.
Yeah, Kentucky's different. Kentucky's where the Appalachians are. It's also a very poor part of the world. And the dogs in Kentucky are the things that worry. They're not chained up, and they would come leaping out of houses, start chasing you down the road, up the hills, down the hills. And they're very dangerous. If they actually run under your wheel, you'll end up having a serious accident. So we tried various ways to distract them. Yelling a lot was one of our techniques. And one of our guys had a makeshift poker that he had that he whacked the dogs with a couple of times when they actually got close enough to bite his ankle. So, you know, they weren't a pleasant experience, but we'd been warned about them all the way along by other cyclists who'd come through that area.
You don't see that in the Tour de France, do you?
We didn't get urine thrown on us neither.
I'm very pleased to hear that. I mean, what was the weather like? Were you pretty lucky with that? Because I would have thought at those high altitudes, if it was rainy, it could have been pretty chilly.
Yeah, so if you start on the west coast, we started when it was still quite chilly, and we got up to some of the passes that still had a lot of snow on them. So they were cold days, and we got a couple of days that rained. Rain and cold is a bad combination. Once we got over the Rockies, we actually got into weather that's not dissimilar to the east coast of Australia here, so hot but very humid. So it was really two parts. West of the Rockies was cool to cold and drizzly and rainy, and the east side was hot, humid, and occasionally rainy. But, you know, rain when it's 75 degrees Fahrenheit is a pleasure, not a pain.
And how many states did you actually go through?
Good question. Seven, I think, at the end of the day. I'd have to go count them again.
And you were there for the 4th of July. Was that pretty special?
Yeah, they do celebrate their 4th of July, like Perth does celebrate Australia Day here. So they have the fireworks. There's lots going on around the. We were near the Ohio River, so they had a big fireworks display from a barge on the Ohio River. They had lots of food stalls, bands playing, music playing. You know, it's not dissimilar to Australia Day, and very 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 enjoyable afternoon.
You were saying at the beginning it was something you'd wanted to do for a long time. Did it live up to expectations?
It was fantastic. You know, would you do it again? No, I couldn't find 12 weeks to do it again. And would you repeat really good experiences? Generally not. You have a really good experience and you tick it off and say, I'll just live with those memories. But it lived up to everything I thought it would be. And I think the people who came along with us for the ride as well had a fantastic time. It was, people were friendly, weather treated us well, no serious accidents except the guy who cut himself, and generally just a bundle of fun.
You mentioned your wife went with it. Did she enjoy it, and she doesn't sort of hate you for forcing her into it?
No. She really enjoyed it. I think we got sick and tired of her every morning saying, oh, this is just absolutely fantastic. Don't you guys think this is fantastic? She's a very positive person anyway, my wife. So she enjoyed it thoroughly, although she's done some damage. She tore her stomach lining up, going up some of the last hill, so she's due for an operation on the weekend to repair that stomach lining. So she probably doesn't think that's a great finish to the ride.
And I mean, just finally, obviously, the Tour de France. We know the guys have to get on their bikes and cycle even after they've completed the race. Did you have to do that, or was it literally put your feet up and go, I've done that now?
No. We actually went to New York afterwards, as I've never been there, and I couldn't resist it. We got the bikes out. We rode around Manhattan Island, and then we rode into Central Park. And Central Park's got a great cycle track that goes for 10Ks around Central Park, so I couldn't resist getting onto it. And since I've got back, I've got onto it because it's probably the peak of peak of my fitness at this stage of my life. So I suspect it's downhill unless I do something about it for the next few years.
Now, I know you said it wasn't the motivating factor, but you did raise money for Wheelchairs for Kids. Can we ask how much you managed to raise?
Yeah, I think the final number was $31,500, $32,000. We were targeting $30,000 because they'd produced their 30,000th wheelchair this year. And it's a great organisation. They produce these wheelchairs for kids in Africa and Southeast Asia. They're really robust. It's run by volunteers. All the people who work there are volunteers. The only money they need is to buy the componentry that goes into them. So we'll be going out to visit them in a couple of weeks' time to say hello and have a cup of tea. And I think as a consequence, they're very pleased that they've got their funding for another year or so.
Maybe you could be cycling across Africa next.
Could be. Nothing's out of the question at the moment. Because people keep asking me, what are you going to do next? I said, I'm going to get back into work for a little while, but then I'll get my head around something else.
Mal Brand, thank you very much.
Pleasure, thanks.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that. I think it's an amazing story. I think the thing that's worrying John is two people coming out of the journey with injuries that have required operations when they've got back to Australia. And hopefully by now those operations have taken place and they've made full recoveries.
I feel sorry for the people involved, but that's the sort of risk you take when you take on those sorts of adventures, isn't it? I mean, that's part of what drives you to do it in the first place is that risk. But whether... I feel sorry for him. No one wants to get hurt.
Just on that, one of our regular guests on Not the Footy Show was Gary Wilmot, who, of course, is running across Australia for the Heart Foundation. He's made it across to Melbourne now. If you want to follow him on the internet, you can. I'm sure if you just look up Gary Wilmot, Race Across Australia, I think it's called. But he's making his way to Brisbane, and it's been fantastic to see the TV coverage he's managed to get and also the promotion he's given to somebody or people that have been obese that have lost weight because, you know, he was a big man. And yeah. He lost, I think it was 45 kilos, and then started running, and now is doing this for the Heart Foundation. So good on you, Gary.
Losing a few more kilos on his way across Australia, I'd suggest.
Well, hopefully we'll catch up with him fairly soon, but at the moment it's very difficult to pin him down to be able to have a chat with him. He's a bit out of breath.
Yeah, future weeks.
Anyway, we probably should just turn our attention, John, to Perth Glory. They've got a new CEO has come in, and he wrote a letter to all of the fans coming into his new role. Look, I think credit to him, as one of the fans said to me, though, it's kind of like more, we're basically announcing that we're going to have another five-year plan. Everyone's saying, well, why didn't you have a five-year plan in the first place? And, you know, you're just updating it. There's a few things. The thing that kind of stuck in my throat a little bit was at the end, the way he signed off and put proud and paid up member number, this, that, and the other, you know, the actual his membership number. Do I really care that the CEO has bought a membership? I mean, seriously, that's in a press release or it was in his open letter. And it's just, I just feel at the moment, everything we get is membership, membership, membership. And it shows to me how desperate the Glory are for members. He's saying in his letter he thinks he can get it up to 10,000 members in a short period of time. I think he's really underestimated the feeling against the Glory in this town from many of their former fans.
I don't know what the Perth Glory stands for. You know, as a person in the community that follows bits of sport, and I know what certain teams and other codes stand for, or the image they portray, and but I don't get it from the Perth Glory. I mean, mission statements and 5-year plans and all that are very all well and good, but all of those in the past have been shown up to be hoaxes by the way the club's conducted itself. So,
Where do I stand
as a fan?
I honestly wonder, John, how much power the new CEO, Peter Philopoulos, is actually going to have, because Anthony Radich has been brought in as the chief operating officer, and my understanding is all of the staff signed new contracts before the new CEO came in and were advised that this was to ensure that their jobs were safe if he decided he wanted to restructure it. So that basically I think his hands are going to be tied. Now, we all know that one of the conditions of the fine that took place last year was that the FFA were going to have a say on who came in as the CEO, that it wasn't going to be a friend of the chairman and the owner, Tony Sage, as has happened in every case in the past. But I just think that what has happened is now they've got a CEO as a figurehead, but I do not think he is going to be able to do half of the things that he says he wants to do.
Okay, so let me read between the lines here a little bit. The Perth Glory are told they're going to have someone from outside come in and have some sort of oversight of what they do. And that person, because they've been okayed by the FFA, the Perth Glory would think they're probably a mole for the FFA. Okay, given that, Sagey's gone, you know what? Let's push him to one side. We'll sign all these people up, and he won't be able to get in and find out any information about us.
Look, I think he's going to find out information. There's no doubt about that. But what he's not going to be able to do is move people on.
The FFA and the Players Association. What is going on there? Because the FFA is saying everything they're telling you about the situation is wrong. We haven't done any of that. Where do they stand?
Look, I don't know. I think from what I can gather, there's a lot of things going on with the PFA at the moment and the FFA. Of course, there's one of the big ones is the Matildas. When it came out how little they earned during the World Cup campaign, understandably, and I think quite rightly, the PFA are fighting for them to get a bigger share. Interestingly, talking to a couple of the players involved in that, they were saying, look, they just want it sorted out. They want to start focusing on Olympic qualification. They missed the Olympics last time around, and they do not want this hanging over their heads. So hopefully the FFA and the PFA will sort that out very quickly. I do think $500 compared with $20,000.
Oh, and you didn't even have to play.
Yeah, is a little bit untoward. Just before we move on from football, the Perth Glory again have to give them a bit of a raspberry in that they due to play the state team, and before they embarked on that game, on the Friday before that game, a letter was sent to Perth Soccer Club saying that they wanted exclusive use of the pitch an hour and a half before the game and exclusive use of the change rooms an hour and a half before the game. Yet they must have known, as it had been agreed before, that there would be a curtain raiser game, which is between, I think it was the state under-20s and Perth Soccer Club's one of their junior development sides. Now, you know, if you want to get the community on side and the local football community, don't put these demands. I mean, we saw it last year with Marconi. They did the same thing and they refused to play the game because a curtain raiser was being played. Stop being so precious. If you need that space, get warmed up or get your massages before you come to the ground. It is, honestly, I think they've really got to recognise their place in the community, which is way, way down at the moment. And if they start putting these requests in, no one's going to want to play them. No one's going to want them at their ground. And they're just going to say, forget it, you know. Quite rightly, Perth Soccer Club said, well, we're just the venue. You need to talk to Football West.
Fair enough.
And then just finally, John, I want to say on this particular point, we're nearing the end of the NPL season. Bayswater have won the league. Congratulations to them. Perth Glory are currently sitting bottom of the ladder. Now, last year, they only won 4 games in the season and finished bottom of the ladder. There is no promotion and relegation because Football West deemed that Mandra didn't meet the criteria, which a lot of people have got furrowed brows about that one and feel that, you know, again, it's a protectionist thing happening. But the thing that I have a problem with is Perth Glory team playing in the NPL should not be coming last 2 seasons in a row. Now, they are younger players, but what good is that doing the players? And I've written a piece on the blog, you know, which is notthefootyshow.com. You may want to read that if you're listening to this. But I think you have to seriously now start looking at whether they're playing in a division that is above their capabilities. Maybe it's time they drop down to the state league competition. Now, if promotion and relegation comes in next year and they come bottom again, are they going to get relegated? The answer is no, because they supposedly have to play in the top flight. But you cannot run a competition where a team is exempt from relegation.
When you run a system of relegation, everybody's got to be under that banner of the chance that it'll happening. And likewise of being promoted. That's why it's organised that way. And to exercise one team from what everybody else is supposed to be doing creates unfair playing field.
But I just think it's detrimental to the development of those players, to the promotion of Perth Glory, to see them sitting bottom of a ladder in that competition. And I think maybe it needs to be revisited. I think maybe the team is better off playing a division below where they may win more games than they're currently winning at the moment.
If I'm the Perth Glory, I would be worried that they're coming last 2 years in a row, because that's where they're supposed to be getting the people, I assume, to fill their squad. You know, these are the guys that are going to have to come in when there's injuries to your main players. So if I'm Sagey, I'm thinking, we've got to do something about this. This cannot go on. It's the old milk and cream stuff again, isn't it?
Hi, this is Ian Healy, and you're listening to This Is Not The Footy Show.
Anyway, it's probably time for us to move on to our second guest on this podcast. And he was a regular on Not The Footy Show in the past. And we're now going to turn our attention to floorball, because Tim Bottler has taken part in the Australian Floorball Open, where WA teams did really well, making the finals of both the men's and the women's competitions. Tim Bottler, welcome back to Not The Footy Show.
Yeah, thanks, Ash. Cheers for having me, mate.
Well, it's good to catch up with you again. And the Australian Floorball Open was on recently up on the Gold Coast, I believe, and WA did really well.
Yep. Both the WA sides did exceptionally well. The women's took it away with a star-studded lineup, and the men's did really well. They knocked off my Melbourne side that I go and play for in the semi-final there, and really put it up to a really star-studded Sydney side in the final and nearly took it away as well.
Is that the first time a WA side has won?
No, WA sides, we pride ourselves over here at being right up there with the floorball competition, and I think the women's side would have won the majority of the competitions that have ever been played, and the men's side, we've maybe had around about 4 or 5 WA sides win that competition.
I find it interesting you say we when you're playing for a Victorian side still.
Yeah, well, I still live here. I still, see all the boys at training and play against them consistently and stuff like that. So I still obviously have a, a fair bit of loyalty to the WA boys. But yeah, when I just enjoy playing with a lot of mates from the Victorian side, the Squishies, and you know, it's a little bit of a family with that type of club, and yeah, I do enjoy it. But yeah, obviously it's nice when WA gets up and can rub it into the other states as well.
Where's the event being held next year?
I don't think it's been announced yet. I'm not 100% sure on what is happening with AFO, whether it's still going on or whether we're going to move to a state-v-state competition. That's all in the woodworks at the moment, but nothing's been announced. But, yeah, just on that, Gold Coast and Queensland Floorball, they ran a superb event. The wind-up that we had, everything was just amazing, well run.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. And I also believe that the Australian men's team has got a new coach.
Oh, well, we do have a new coach, but it's the same old coach that we had last time. So Daniel Dornack's taken the reins again. His job was up for review and up for offer. So I don't know whether nobody else just put in or whether he got it again. But yeah, very happy that Daniel's got it again. Obviously, with the success that he's brought from the boys from last year at the World Cup and at APAC, we'll be looking hopefully to qualify again in, was it January, over in Thailand, I believe it is.
Right, so you, when do you start training for that?
Training's just started. So the selection criteria got sent out the other day. We've changed it all up and stuff like that, making it a lot more professional, which is great to see, and really giving a lot more avenues for players who maybe didn't get selected for the last or haven't been selected before. It's giving them a lot more avenues to get selected, and also giving them, you know, pointers of what to work on and how to work on it and stuff like that. So the selection, I don't know the full selection process with that, but training has started with your states, and then we'll obviously have some training camps, one over here in the West Coast and one over in the East Coast as well.
And the women have got their World Cup in December this year, don't they?
They do, and they did get a new coach. So Tom Hoogland, he unfortunately has left the job, and they've now got another WA boy, Grant Mead, back in the scene. He's coached the women's before and been an assistant coach, and he's coached the men's as well. So he's coming in with a lot of experience, and he's believe that side is going to get announced very soon. And yeah, they play away in December, where that play has eluded me at this stage. But yeah, the side, from what I could see at AFO, they're going to have a very good side and a very young side as well by the looks of it. Obviously, I don't know what team's going to get selected yet, but at that, you know, they're looking good to hopefully continue on the success that the men had at the last World Champs.
And the World Cup is very much now, isn't it? It's just a sort of, you're in pools and then it's knockout rather than in different divisions as it used to be?
Yep. So you've got to qualify. So the women qualified this January, I think it was, in Melbourne. There was a qualification. And you've got to qualify, same as the men have to do in Thailand next year. So you have to qualify out of your region. And then once you qualify, you get split into your pools. And they do the pools with the top eight, all in a pool, or two pools together. And the bottom eight are in a pool, they're two pools together as well. And then the winners obviously go. And that's just to make it a little bit more even as well. But you've still got to qualify to get away. So you can't just rock up.
No, exactly, I'm sure. You don't want that at a World Cup. Yeah, I think I'll participate in this year.
Yeah, we'll just rock up for this one. I think India's been primed for that, so, yeah.
And what about the local scene? Is the league about to get underway again soon?
Yes, it is. I'm excited about that. So, season starts in the 17th of October, and our great committee have actually organised a well, for the Perth people, it's kind of a little bit of a pre-season show in Northam. There's going to be a Northam Floorball Open, so everyone's welcome to come down to that. That's on the 10th of October, so a week before the season starts. And yeah, it's looking good. I haven't actually seen confirmations of how many teams in this competition this year, but it's growing every year, so I can only imagine that it's going on the upward spiral as it always has.
One thing's having the competition grow, but what's the standard like? Is that improving with every season as well?
It does. It does. Obviously, it does go with personnel as well. So some seasons you'll lose a lot of senior players through either having babies, getting married, retirement, old age, all that. But the youth now that's coming through that I've started to see, every season they're improving immensely. They're bringing, you know, new things to the game, new thoughts, new styles, everything like that. So for the last 5 years, it's been just absolutely building up. And from what I could see at the AFO tournament, especially from the WA boys, the WA team, they brought over quite a young side. The competition this year is going to be extremely difficult again. And with the women having their World Cup, they're obviously at full training, so a lot of them will be in form as well, so they'll help, you know, build up our competition as well.
And who are you playing for this year?
Playing for my club, Perth Dragons. Yep, so we're looking good. We've picked up a whole heap of players, which is good. And, yeah, hopefully we can, nobody gets pregnant or has another child this year, and we can have a full complement of players for a complete season.
Well, it sounds like it's all moving in the right direction. I know there was a big push for floorball to try and get Olympic entry, and I hear that they've now actually got all the numbers to actually put in a bid to the IOC.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, that has happened. I think we've gone in for a demo sport or something along that line. And I'm not sure where that process is up to. That's, unfortunately, I don't hear all the information, but as far as I'm aware, if we could get that, that would just be an amazing thing for the sport, for the people involved, for, you know, everything everyone who's been a part of floorball for a long time, you know, dreamt of something like that, and it'd be a great thing for probably the younger generation to be able to experience.
It certainly would. Well, Tim, it's great catching up with you once again, and no doubt we'll talk soon.
Yep, definitely. Thanks, Ash. Cheers for having me on.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
And that was Tim Bottler from the world of floorball.
I've been picking up a bit of anecdotal floorball evidence lately. I've been hearing people in odd places mention it, not rabbiting on about it, but it's come up a few times. It's obviously a sport that's starting to grow.
Well, I think we had the figures not that long ago about the growth in Australia, and it was the fastest growing sport in Australia. I think that was about 18 months ago I was given the figures, and we discussed that on air before. I think it is going really well. I hear that they now have the quota to qualify for Olympic participation, and they're looking to put in a case, not this time around because that's already come up and they missed the deadline for that, but the next time there are sports applying for the Olympics, they will be applying for that.
Oh, I'm sure the FIH is looking closely at this as it goes on.
You would think so, John. I mean, I would suggest that the two of them maybe ought to look at getting together.
It does make sense on many levels. Individually, the sports might go, oh, hang on a sec, no, we want to keep a level of individuality about it. But I can certainly see them working under the same umbrella together.
There's a lot of synergies between the two.
Is.
And there's a lot of people playing both sports.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, it makes sense. But you know what it's like, sports administrators, merging.
And there's people... The younger people would probably be more inclined to take on something like that than older people. And I'm a bit that way sometimes about things. So I can understand why there would be people within hockey or floorball that go, oh, no, we're not going with them. But, you know, looking forward, you've really got to start considering those sorts of things.
And I think even more so when the figures in Australia for junior participation in field hockey are actually really down. The growth area is in the masters age group. So this may be a chance to actually grow the junior ranks.
It makes it more accessible to people, and in countries where they don't have the sorts of weather that allows you to play outdoor hockey all year round. I mean, a hockey field is big, and a floorball court is not as big, so you probably get several in the same size under a roof. Makes sense.
Certainly does. And before we wrap up, well, it would be wrong of us not to mention...
Oh, no, here it comes.
Well, we've got to mention it. The Ashes are back in England.
Mm-hmm. Disappointing.
It was, but...
The way it happened was disappointing.
Absolutely. But you have to say, John, if you look at the trends of world cricket now, very few touring teams win away from home. And I think that is terrifying because what's happening, and I hate it because when I was growing up, sometimes you never got the chance to go to a test match. It was beyond your reach, but you could see the touring sides play against a county side. You could afford to go to that. It was sometimes more accessible to go to that game. Now where they're trying to fit in one-day internationals, T20 internationals, and a test series, the county games, which are crucial to the players acclimatising to the conditions in the new country. You take when Sri Lanka last came to Australia, they played a warm-up game in Tasmania, the first test in Perth. Are you trying to tell me that's really going to help them prepare for a test match in Perth? No way.
Cricket's an interesting case because the result can be so dependent on the weather. Now, for most other sports, okay, one team might come from a warm country, one might come from a cold, but when it actually comes to playing the game, the conditions are same for both teams. Whereas that isn't true in cricket. Conditions change and can be different for both teams. And Australia copped a little bit of that when the test last one, where they got rolled for 60. I mean, that game started under dark, dark cloud and was almost delayed, the start of that match. And it was like, why did we bat? Why? But having said that, when they're about 5-0, I said Australia should declare now because the sun's just come out. And it was always going to get... I'm not saying that England didn't bat well or Australia couldn't have bowled better, but the conditions were going to change and it was always going to be easier once that sun came out and dried that pitch out a little bit.
But again, John, history in England cricket will tell you that first hour
exactly
is the key moment. And the biggest concern for me is how flawed the Australian batsmen's techniques are. And I think it's from playing too much T20.
I agree with you. They're
pushing at the ball. They're all playing in the Big Bash. Then they're playing loads of T20 games over here.
And when they do play here, you can push at the ball a lot more than you can in England. You know,
because the ball comes on to you.
Exactly. You can play that way. I think what's happened, part of the reason, is the homogenisation of pitches. Who in that touring party was the equal of the bowler of a Terry Alderman or a Damien Fleming or even a Paul Rifle? None of them could swing the ball consistently with any sort of accuracy like the England bowlers could. Now, what we've lost in this country is the art of swing bowling. Name me the best swing bowler in this country at the moment.
I can't. I think I'm trying to struggle.
There are guys who can swing it, but they're not swing bowlers. Stark can swing it, but he has no idea when or where it's going to happen.
That was my point. I can't name a consistent bowler in Australia. Siddle is probably the one that you would pick, and he hasn't had a game.
Siddle's not real. He's more of a seamer, too.
He will be able to bowl you maiden overs. Now, if you've got your Mitchell Johnson and your Mitchell Stark at the other end, who are a little bit wild, as you said, don't know exactly. You need a guy at the other end just pinning the batsman down so that they have a go at that the guy at the other end. And I remember going to the Ace Academy, which sadly is closed down at UWA, and Bob Massey was the coach there. And he was telling me they do not teach the bowlers now how to swing a ball.
No.
They're literally just told, put the seam between your fingers, run in and bowl it and hit the deck as hard as you can.
Oh, and I mean, I'm not a great bowler by any stretch of the imagination. I can't do the things, you know, that you have to do. I mean, which way you point your feet?
Foot position, arm follow through.
You know,
There's so many things that can make a big difference, you know, on how the ball is delivered. And especially in England, you can make it go both ways by actually having good technique in your bowling technique.
And the other side of Australia lacking decent swing bowlers in the competition, as we look at it, is that the batsmen aren't facing them either. So when Australia had that great run of Ashes victories in England, in the nets, these guys, the batsmen, were facing your Aldermans and your Flemings and your Rifles and the bowlers like that. When they're facing the batsmen we have now aren't facing those bowlers in the nets around the country and they do their everyday practice. So we've lost that ability to play good swing bowling.
But let me ask you another question, John. I mean, when you watch the cricket, how often do you see one of the bowlers change the angle on the crease, bowl one from wide of the crease? I can't remember seeing an Australian bowler do that.
Not an Australian one.
Yeah. You know, and it's amazing. If the ball's swinging a little bit, you just change that angle. It changes the whole way the shot. They think the ball's coming in the same spot. You know, you can pick up a lot of wickets that
Mitchell way. Johnson will set guys up. But maybe it's, I haven't, he does do that when I think about it.
Yeah.
But
he's about the only one, and he changes his pace extremely well.
I mean, Hazelwood's a good bowler.
I think he's very good. He's not there yet, though.
Yeah.
But then you
wait. There's guys around.
When England come out here, I mean, if England come out here, when are they here? In another 18 months or so? If they bring Anderson and Broad...
They won't bring Anderson.
Nah, they'll lose the Ashes. The thing is, will Finn have learnt from his experience before? Will he bowl short here? They've got to find bowlers that can come and bowl here. And I think the way, as you said, with the drop-in pitches and the way it is, you've got horses for courses now, and you cannot stick with the same team wherever you go.
I would implore Australian cricket authorities to try and get the state capital pitches back to what the state capital pitches were. Australian batsmen in the Shield competition should be going to Sydney and thinking, this is going to bloody turn. And they should be going to the Gabba and the Wacker thinking, oh, it's going to seam at the Gabba. It's going to bounce and swing at the Wacker.
Well, of course, that could all end if the Wacker does, in fact, move to the new stadium. And I had someone from the UK contact me actually only a week ago saying they've heard the Wacker will not be no more for the next Ashes series.
That would be really, really sad. I mean, you might as well go and play cricket matches on a highway then. If everything turns to these homogenised drop-in pitches, then it's going to get boring.
Well, I think a lot of the cricket-loving West Australians will not be wanting to go to the new stadium.
Oh, once again, we're not going to be going to see what we wanted to go and see. When you go to the Wacker, you want to see a really fast, hard wicket that gives bowlers and batsmen a chance. Plenty of batsmen have scored big runs on the first day at the Wacker playing against decent speed bowling. You know, it's not just a bowl. It's not a batsman's graveyard, the Wacker.
It's not. Well, we're going to have to leave you now. We've probably yabbered on a little bit too long, but we hope you've enjoyed another podcast from me, Ashley Morrison.
And me, John Lee.
Goodbye.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.